Om Ajnanatimirandasyajnananjanashalakaya Chakshanamilitam Genatashmi Sri Gurave Namah Nam Shrishtam Manumapi Satchiputram Matrasarupam Rupam Tasya Brajamarupurim Matalim Gosthavatim Radha Kundam Gidivaram Maham Radhika Madhavasam Prapto Yasya Pratita Kripaya Shri Gurum Tamnatasmi Vancha Kalpataru Vyascha Kripa Sandhu Vyayivacha Patita Nam Pavane Pyo Vaishnave Pyo Namo Nikila Shruti Mole Ratna Mala Dhyuti Nirajita Padapanka Janta Aji Mukta Kulai Rupa Shamanam Paritashtam Harinam Samshayame Anarapita Charem Chirat Karunayava Tiranakalam Shamar Paitamun Natoj Balarasam Sohakti Shriyam Hari Purata Sundara Dhyuti Kadamba Sandipita Sadahridaye Kandare Shpurato Vasachinandana Ajana Lambita Bujo Kanaka Vodatum Sankirtanai Kapitaru Kamalaya Takshum Vishwambaro Duyavaro Jugadharma Pal Vandi Jagat Priyakuro Karuna Avataru Ladini Shakti Sarupaya Goranga Suridaya Cha Bhakta Shakti Pradanaya Gadadhara Namastita He Krishna Karuna Sindho Dinabando Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namaste Radhe Brindavanadi Shri Karunamrita Vahini Kripaya Nijapadabja Dasyan Mahim Pradiyatam Bhaktya Vihinaya Paradha Lakshay Chitta Shakamaditarangamadhye Kripa Maitvam Sharanam Prapanam Vrinde Namaste Charanaravindam Vrinde Namaste Charanaravindam Shri Sachinandan Gaurhari ki Jai Shri Shri Gaur Nityanand ki Jai Shri Harinam Sankirtan ki Jai Shri Shri Radha Madmohan Radha Govinda Dev Radha Gopinajju ki Jai Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki Jai Gaur Praman ki Jai Sadhu Sangh ki Jai. So, welcome to all of you. Dhanyavaad. Thank you so much for your company and for your time. As we were saying yesterday, Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita says that he's time personified. So if you are giving me your time, you are giving me Krishna, basically. So thank you so much for that. So many ways to give Krishna to each other. So one of those is giving our time, our presence, our attention. That's giving Krishna to each other. So thank you for that. It seems that I'm the one here giving something to you, but actually I'm one receiving so much from all of you. So thank you. Deep gratitude. So today I felt some inspiration to share some words about what Sadhu Sangha. We just say Sadhu Sangha Ki Jai. So we'll try to unpack what does it mean. What does it mean to say Sadhu Sangha Ki Jai? Because we say many times per day Ki Jai and it can become something normalized. Well, each Ki Jai should remain an extraordinary event. If we say Ki Jai, which means all glories or all victory to something, means that we are talking about something which is of a different nature, so to say. But like many things, we can get accustomed to the extraordinary. So we can get accustomed to words like Sadhu Sangha, Sankirtan, Ki Jai. All our Gaudiya glossary is filled with extraordinary concepts, extraordinary realities, but they can become, I'd say, common parlance. Like we can become accustomed just like, yeah, sadhu sangha, yeah, this is. And we lose sight of the actual reality of that word, that term. So recently, a few days ago, 1 week ago, we were in Michigan with some devotees, and we had a retreat called Reclaiming Our Ideals. So part of the intention of the retreat was trying to reclaim many of these terms, many of these concepts, which are so deep and so valuable, but that sometimes we really start to relate to them in very casual and superficial ways. No? Terms like surrender, no? Terms like humility, like sankirtan, like satsanga. So with your permission, without your permission, no problem, I'd like to enter a little bit into the direction of sadhu sangha. And what sadhu sangha? And of course, I can only touch one point in an infinite line. We are not here trying to give the final, conclusive, overarching definition of sadhu sangha. It's unlimited realities, ever unfolding, ever evolving. That brings to my mind this famous, beautiful verse from Chaitanya Charitamrita. Krishna Bhakti Janma Mool How is Sadhu Sangha? Krishna Prem Janmatenho Punar Mokyanga. So Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami says, first line, the root cause of Krishna Bhakti is Sadhu Sangha. I'm not going here to my first book, no problem. I'm seeing Amras getting concerned here. That's not the case. There's a whole book for that, for those interested, no? How the root cause of bhakti is sadhu sangha. But the second line, I'm trying to focus there, Krishna Prem Janmaten Hamu Punar Mukya. When Krishna Prem is born or manifests, sadhu sangha, and the first line says sadhu sangha is the beginning of bhakti. But then it says, when you reach the highest end of bhakti, Krishna Prem, divine love, sadhu sangha remains punar mukya anga, remains a main limb, a main expression of divine love. So sadhu sangha, which sometimes is translated as association with devotees, keeps being a main feature in transcendence, right? It's not like, okay, now I need sadhu sangha because I'm whatever, conditioned soul, and I would like to attain eternity, but once I'm there, I can take a break from the sadhus. Sometimes it can be a little intense, so I have my holiday corner there in Vaikuntha and Golok, and that's it for a while. That's not the way ideal. Our ideal is actually when you reach that level, that platform, that realm of consciousness called spiritual world, sadhu sangha becomes all the more important. Because again, for us bhakti, we practice bhakti so we can practice bhakti. Right? Our goal of bhakti is not at some point I'm leaving bhakti yet to do something else. It's not the closer I get to the goal, the more my bhakti diminishes. But on the contrary, the more I get closer to the goal, the more bhakti augments. And when I reach the goal, bhakti keeps augmenting. So in one sense, I never reach the goal because it always keeps expanding. You follow? It's not that I reach the goal, okay, no more expansion of love, expansion of sadhu sangha. No, no. It continues to unfold forever. So my point is, if the more I practice bhakti, the closer we get to our goal, so to say, the more bhakti becomes more important, the more I engage in sadhu sangha, the more sadhu sangha becomes the primary feature. The better, the deeper my connection with other fellow practitioners will become. So that's an important point to make clear first. Sadhu sangha is not just like a temporary means to hang out for a while with each other and at some point just, I don't need you anymore. No, no, I need you for eternity. That's the idea, basically. The more we go deep into our ideal, the more the things that we are already doing become more and more important, more and more crucial. All the things that we are doing already, kirtan, sadhu sangha, and so on and so forth, the closer we get to the goal, getting closer to the goal means awakening to how important all those things that we are already doing. We can put it like that. What does it mean to get to the goal of Krishna Bhakti? You will realize the depth and breadth and endless potential of what you are already doing. It's not that you will end up doing something different. Again, you will continue doing what you are doing, but with a very deep and broad vision. So today we'll like to share some words about that, how we can start to see and appreciate this notion of Sadhu Sangha in a more and more important light. Inspired of this line of Chaitanya Charitamrita, Krishna Prem Janmeten Ho Punar Mokya Anga. When divine love manifests, Sadhu Sangha becomes all the more important. Not less and less important, but more and more important. So if every aspect of our practice in time becomes more and more important, that will only happen if we are relating to those aspects now, bearing their importance in mind, so to say. If we remain open and aware of how important Sadhu Sangha is, that will allow that in time that will become more and more important. But if nowadays I become accustomed to say, oh, Sadhu Sangha, yeah, it's like normal daily stuff, probably Sadhu Sangha won't become more and more important. Because I'm seeing that as some casual, ordinary thing. Oh, yeah, prasad, yeah, japa, yeah, holy name, yeah, Sadhu Sangha. Actually, all of them are super extraordinary portals, right, to transcend. So what's Sadhu Sangha also? No? Let's begin by defining the words. No, I like to go to the bare definition. Sadhu and Sangha. Sadhu. What does it mean, sadhu? How will you translate sadhu? And rasa. We talked about this last year when we went to Syracuse. A little bit. And you were there.
I don't remember what I had for lunch.
You were there. So someone asks you, what's a sadhu? How will you translate the word sadhu?
Someone who is...
Don't think too much. Don't think too much. Give the immediate answer that you will give it someone else.
A saintly person.
Saintly person. Okay. So what's a saintly person? When you hear the word saintly, what comes to your mind? Like someone very, very elevated, very deep, impeccable character. I don't want to put words in your mouth, yeah, but I'm just asking. Because again, we use words, but each word has an association in our own minds that it may differ from others. But saintly is a pretty big word. Mm-hmm. Saintly is close to saint, right? So he's a saint. That's like, okay, some pedestal is there, right?
There, yeah.
we are increasing the standard, no? Sadhu, saintly, saint.
One who has the aura of Krishna prayer.
Okay, that's way up there. That's, yeah. Of course, that's Sadhu Sangha in its ultimate facet. But I like to get down a little bit from those peaks.
One who guards the not of material attachment.
Okay, that gives more hope.
One with the Diksha Karunika.
Again?
One who has the Diksha Karunika.
Okay. Different qualities of a devotee. I like to give you a particular definition, which is, of course, not mine, but just it's Krishna's definition of what's a sadhu. Mm-hmm. Not to contradict any of what you say, just to put all on the scale. And to have a hopeful beginning point when we talk about sadhu and sadhu sangha. So in the Bhagavad Gita, the word sadhu is employed, if I'm not mistaken, 3 times. So, and the most important verse in which the word sadhu is employed is in one of the most important verses of the Bhagavad Gita, arguably the most controversial verse of the Bhagavad Gita. Do you know that better than me? In Bhagavad Gita, 9th chapter, verse 30, Apichetsuduracharu bhajante mam nanyabhag sadhur eva samantavya samyakvya vyasituhisa. So I like to contrast a little bit what's said there with what we are talking so far. No? If we conceive sadhu as a person who is saint, impeccable conduct, hyper elevated, someone who has Krishna Prem, different possibilities. Now, how Krishna begins this verse? He's saying, Apichet Siduracharo. Generally, when we think a sadhu is an acharya, let's say, an acharya, a great devotee, a great personality. But Krishna here is saying Sudurachar. He's not starting with achar. He's not even starting with durachar. He started with Sudurachar. What does it mean? Achar means good behavior, right? Yeah. Durachar means bad behavior. And Sudurachar means
super abominable.
Super hyper maxim ever, whatever. Bad behavior. So that's how the official definition of a sadhu starts in the Bhagavad Gita. Another reason for this to be the most controversial verse. But Krishna says, Apiche, even though someone may be of very bad behavior so far, but jante mam ananyabak, if that person is worshipping me, ananya means ananya. Anya means like other, and ananya means without other. Sometimes it's translated as exclusively. We could say with sincere focus, okay, I want to give myself to Krishna. I want to surrender myself to him. Even though I'm still of very bad behavior, not intentionally, but because of whatever, previous karma, acquired nature. So Krishna says, if you are that sincere, that honest in your approach to me, even though you are a mess, till now, sadhuriva samantuvya. For me, in my opinion, in my consideration, that person is a sadhu. Because such a person is properly situated in his, her determination. So that's an interesting definition of sadhu. Again, Krishna is not saying that you are a saintly, perfect conduct and behavior, Krishna Prem. Of course, that's also sadhu. And this verse can have so many applications. Now, there are many purports to this verse. The ultimate, it applies to the gopis of Braja, that they seem to be of very bad behavior, transgressing all Vedic law and running to Krishna in the dead of the night and so on. So ultimately that verse speaks about the gopis, the ultimate sadhus. But also it can apply on a more preliminary level to someone who is very sincere, but for whatever reason still doesn't have the greatest behavior, but very sincere and very honest. So Krishna said, for me, you are already a sadhu. So that's a very generous definition of sadhu. Not to abuse the definition, of course. We are not saying that, okay, I can continue with my sudurachar, but I'm very sincere. So Krishna, no, if you say that, that means you are not very sincere. If you genuinely repent by the bad behavior and try to do the best to reform, transform yourself, okay, that's another thing. But if we take this as an excuse to further justify that, that's not what Krishna's talking about. But he's from a very broad and deep and generous perspective. He's saying, even if you don't behave in the best way, but you are honest and sincere. So that's the main emphasis here. Be honest. Be sincere. Because you can be a very good behavior, very paka and following all rules and regulations, but probably you may not be that sincere or that honest that someone who fails, but the failure itself takes the person to open his her heart with humility and sincerity and pray to God from a very authentic place. And I may be following everything very paka and get proud of that. So who is better situated in that case, right? So Bhava Grahi Janardana. Krishna is taking the essence of our attitude. No? He's not just seeing, okay, you are impeccable in your external adherence to the rules. Where's your heart? That I'm taking note of. So, and that I reciprocate with. So ultimately, honesty is emphasized here. For example, in the verse, another famous verse of the Bhagavatam, that bad bhiksargo janataga viplavojasmim pratishlokam abadavatipi, and so on. The last word of the verse, srimbanti gayanti grinanti sadhava. Sadhava. It's another word of saying sadhu. How Prabhupada translates that word, something like men or women who are utterly honest. So that's interesting. He's not saying they're saintly people. He's saying people who is utterly honest. Again, goes back to the same definition of the Gita. Being a sadhu means to be utterly honest, utterly sincere, utterly authentic. And that's the audience that the Srimad Bhagavatam is directed to. Dharma prajito kaito gotra paramo nirmat saranam satam vidyam. So this book will be vidyam, understood by satam, by those who are utterly honest. So that's a sadhu, someone who is honest. Honest whether being successful or when being failing in something, but you're honest. You remain honest and transparent. And even if you make a so-called mistake, if you are honest, there is totally warranty that you will be growing by being like that. Krishna says in the next verse of the Gita that I quoted a few minutes ago, Nami Bhakta Pranashiti. After saying, my sadhu may have not very good behavior, but be very honest. And then he says to Arjuna, proclaim that my devotee never perishes. No. My sadhu, someone who is that honest, never perishes. In the words of Srila Siddhar Maharaj, he will say, sincerity is invincible. Sincerity is invincible. If you are sincere, there's no way that you will experience defeat. Krishna is on your side 108%. You have that backing, you can move forward with great hope and confidence. Krishna is protecting me. He will continue to protect me. He's maintaining me. As long as I remain sincere, that will be the fact always. And I think I mentioned that, but I will mention in this context. We are talking about sadhu as sincere. And the word sincere, I don't know if you know the origin of the word. From Sanskrit, we'll go to our language. So sincere comes from the time of the Roman Empire. In Latin, you have this word sincera. In Spanish, also similar. So it goes back to the time where there were different people who worked with, like, carving, making sculptures out of marble. So there will be a market where you will buy the big chunks of marble to work on, sculpt on. So there were one section of the market who was not so sincere, not so honest. So they will have big pieces of marble, but with different crackings. So they will cover the crackings with wax. White wax. So you will see the piece and say, wow, this is perfect. Mm. Wax in Latin or in Spanish is cera. So you will buy that piece because you say, wow, this is the most perfect one. So you start to work. But when you go on the cracking, the work is over. And there was another section in the market, a more sincere one. They will have these pieces showing the crackings. Mm. Like, this is what it is. It is without wax. Sincera. Without is sin, Spanish, Latin, and wax is cera. So you can make your piece of art, including the cracking, which is another lesson there. You can make a whole sculpture, crackings including, imperfections included. No? The kintsugi art in Japan, no? Like they broke some like jar, instead of throwing it, they fill it with liquid gold. They highlight the brokenness, right? It's part of, it's integrated into the art of it. No? So that's another message for us in bhakti. We don't need to hide anything and look perfect in every sense. We can be imperfect, even that's highlight. If we are sincere, the highlight of our brokenness is like liquid gold, basically.
It could be crack.
Sorry?
It could be crack. Yeah. It could be a crack. Mm-hmm.
So my point is sincere means then you are not hiding your brokenness. You are not hiding your cracks. No, you are shown for who you are, but sincerely, honestly. And Krishna, take, you are sadhu rema samantavya. You are my sadhu. You are honest. You are sincere. So that means sadhu, basically. Mm-hmm. Come from sat. Sat means truth. No, that which is real. So a sadhu is a real person, basically, an honest person. As it is. As Prabhupada will say, Bhagavad Gita, as it is. Mm-hmm. We need everything as it is. We need Navrasa as he is. No. Swamipadmana as he is. And so everything has to be as it is. Not only the Bhagavad Gita. We have to be as honest as we can. So sadhu sangha, and the word sangha can translate as association, but also sangha, if you go to the Bhagavad Gita, the word sangha is mostly used, means attachment. Attachment. I won't go to each section, but that's the meaning. But so my point is sadhu sangha, if we take sadhu as someone very honest and authentic and sincere, and Sangha is attachment. You have the meaning of Sadhu Sangha. No? Sadhu Sangha means attachment to honesty. No? It's a gathering. The nature of the gathering will be such that we get attached to be honest. Like we get together attached to being honest with one another, basically. At least that's how based on scripture and Sanskrit possibilities to translate the words, that's how Sadhu Sangha looks for me. What's real Sadhu Sangha? Sadhu Sangha for me is not a social function, so to say. No, like we get together and we know what to say and where to say kijai. And so, I'm not condemning that, but I'm saying the deep meaning of that is we are getting together to increase our attachment to being honest, to show to each other with honesty, basically, no? With transparency, with sincerity, not try to hide our cracking, so to say, but sharing our brokenness, sharing our struggles, sharing our beauty and realizations and everything, our gifts, our triumphs, our failures, no? All can be shared. Again, if there's honesty, all can be shared. I don't care if it's triumph or failure, Krishna said, as long as it's honest, bringing to the table whatever is there, so to say. As long as it's honest, it's okay. Yeah. So we can have days of, sometimes I say, of inspiring hope. Bring that to the table. We'll celebrate that together. And some days we may have days of humbling failure. Bring that to the table. We'll grieve together. That's how the Sangha goes. We will accompany each other. And there's no need to fake, no? As they say, like here, fake it till you make it. Oh, and I like to, the idea came, I like play of words sometimes, sorry for that. It's a radical personalism I wrote that came, instead of fake it till you make it, it's naked till you make it. No? Like you have to be naked in terms of vulnerable and open and transparent till you make it. That will take you to make it, really, no? To be honest, not fake it, but naked internally. No? This transparency is what Sadhu Sangha is about. So on that basis, on that foundation of defining Sadhu Sanghas, getting attached to be honest with one another, of course we can from that basis develop, okay, how that will look like, how that association with devotees in that term will look like. And Rupa Goswami makes it very clear, both in his Upadeshamrita and his Bhaktirasamrita Sindhu. For example, in the Bhaktirasamrita Sindhu, what does Rupa Goswami say? He mentions three attributes of Sadhu Sangha: Swajatya, Svatavara, and Snigdasya. You may recall these three. So these three means, Swajatya means you have to associate, get together with like-minded people, no? People that you feel we are vibrating aligned with a similar search and a similar spirit and a similar mode and so on. Then he says Svatavara, which means higher practitioners. That's the meaning of that. But another meaning of Svatavara could mean we may get together as peers. That's a form of Sadhu Sangha. Of course, one form of Sadhu Sangha is sometimes defined as the guru-disciple relationship. For example, when Rupa Goswami says Shraddha, Sadhu Sangha, Bhajana, Kriya, Nartha, Nivritti, Nishtha, Rucha, Sakti, Bhava, Prem, these nice stages. When Sadhu Sangha comes, Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur Madhurya Kadamini defines Sadhu Sangha mostly as being initiated by a guru and beginning Bhajana, Kriya, and so on. So we could take Sadhu Sangha as, okay, guru-disciple relationship, and Svatavara means ideally the guru is higher than the disciple, and from that direction one can learn and so on. But also we can, of course, Sadhu Sangha also means we can be associated among peers, among equals on some level. So how does Svatavara applies there? No? How something higher will manifest among peers? Well, that's possible. No? Because I will say again, if each one of those people in that group are, again, sadhu, are honest, are sincere, are transparent, and they get together, something higher will manifest through them. Now, let's say that you have a group of, to give an example, 2, 3, 4, 5, whatever, sincere Madhyam Bhaktas, what we will call intermediate devotees. If all of them are very honest and open in their Madhyam stage, some Uttam Siksha or some instruction of a higher level can descend and manifest through that. It's not that because we are all Madhyams or Kanishka or whatever, nothing higher can come. No, no. If we get together with this sincere spirit, we somehow become transparent, be a medium of a higher current that can manifest. And I think all of us may have had some experience of that on some level or another, that you are being like transpassed by something that is way above your head. I mean, to me, it happens sometimes giving lecture. Like I'm talking and I start to say something like, wow, that's cool, what I've just said. I cannot be falsely humble. I said, no, that's horrible. I said, like, wow, that was great. But immediately I'm realizing it was not me. So there is something higher that is coming, even if I'm not that qualified, but when the higher reality want to manifest, and we are trying to be sincere, so if there is some attempt, we cannot deny the descent of something of a higher quality, so to say. So that's another way of understanding Sadhu Sangha Svatavara. We may not be the topmost, highest Paramahamsa Mahabhagavats on earth, but there is, if there is Sadhu Sangha, if there is attachment to being honest, something very high can manifest through us. The Bible there will say, when two or three gather in my name, I am there. Krishna says something similar in the Gita. Machita madgata prana bhudayanta parashparam katayanta shramam nityanta shanti charamantita. He's speaking about what, when the devotees get together, how they nourish each other, enlighten each other, give pleasure to each other. And in one sense, it implies that also. It's not so much that I'm doing that to you and I'm giving that to you necessarily. It's also, we get together, we are open, and someone else comes. Now, this is this famous story of the devotees from the Sri Sampradaya. They were in Chaturmasya. In India, the rainy season, so they get stuck in one, I think it was a cave or something. We will never know that detail. But there were three of them in one cave for a few days. But they were very sincere in sadhusan, very attached to being honest. And at one point of their conversation, they said, I don't know if you think like me, but I feel the presence of a fourth person here. And the other one said, yes. Yelava said, yes. And that fourth person is the person we are talking about now here, Krishna, God. No? He made himself manifest through us. No? So basically, that's the idea of Sadhu Sangha. That's the idea of Sankirtan. Sankirtan, again, implies Sadhu Sangha. No? Sankirtan is a collective miracle. It's not something that I can do by myself. I'll pick my cartels and do Sankirtan. As I say sometimes, you can do some kirtan. With all respect, and sure, that's great. But Sankirtan, we need each other. And for me, that's beautiful. No? Like the very implication of the main practice of our tradition is telling you, you need each other in order to do that. You cannot do it by yourself. So in itself, it's humbling, and it showcases how much more can happen when we get in together, when we get in communion with each other. So how much can happen by ourselves, but when each one of us get together with honesty and transparency, be ready to witness a miracle. Now, that's the idea, that in real Sadhu Sangha, we are getting together, and we may not know what will happen, but we know for sure something unique will happen. It cannot not happen. And we have to have this implicit trust that it cannot not happen. If we are honest and sincere and we get together with our openness, Krishna has to manifest. He promises that. He makes that point over and over again. So we have to enter the circle of Sadhu Sangha with that implicit trust. If I enter a circle of sincere souls attached to being honest in the pursuit of truth, something extraordinary has to happen. And it will happen. Cannot not happen. That's the niche that we have to have, the firm faith. No? So again, going back to Rupa Goswami, he says, Swajatiya, no? Sadhu Sangha has to be like-minded, Swatavara, with higher people or with people, again, in such a way that something higher will manifest, even between equals, or even between someone junior to me. If that person is utterly sincere, so many things can come from that person. I mean, Bhagavatam has the 24 gurus. No? The gurus there are a prostitute and a child and material elements that you could say they're not Uttam Bhagavatas, but for the Brahman, there is all of them are part of my parampara, Siksha parampara. And then Rupa Goswami says, it's Nigdasya, affectionate. Sadhu Sangha has to be affectionate. There has to be concern, loving concern for one another. There has to be empathy. There has to be personalism. I will call it radical personalism. There, we have to be radically personal in connecting with one another through affection. And that's Sadhu Sangha. When Rupa Goswami says Sadhu Sangha should be Svatabhara, Snigdasya, and Svajatiya, these three things, he's not saying, ideally, try to get that in your Sadhu Sangha. No, no, he's saying, that's Sadhu Sangha. Without that, that's not Sadhu Sangha. I mean, that's the implication. Without affection, intimacy, empathy, openness, so something higher comes, and like-mindedness, we cannot speak about Sadhu Sangha. We have to find another word. And probably the word we need for that is Asad Sangha. Really?
Sure.
Yeah. Because Asad Sangha, Mahaprabhu will say Asad Sangha Tyag I Vaishnava Achar. But there you have it. Madan Gopal Prabhu is supporting the truth, this statement. Mahaprabhu is saying the behavior of a Vaishnava is defined by avoiding Asad Sangha. But sometimes we have this idea, oh, Asat Sangha means whatever. Maya bad atheists, demons, and monsters, and all the bad people who are outside there. No, no, no. I mean, also can be, but let's begin at home. Asat Sangha is just any type of gathering or connection with people when there is no affection, no honesty, no transparency, no higher flow of truth, no like-mindedness. That's Asat Sangha. So that can happen in the name of Sadhu Sangha many times. Mm-hmm. It can be like, how to say, disguised as Sadhu Sangha without bad intention from anyone. But we end up using the word Sadhu Sangha, but actually sometimes there is no affection. There's the contrary of that, the opposite of that. There's no intimacy, empathy, openness, transparency. There's the opposite of that. There is fear, there is calculation, there is criticism, there is prejudice, there is bias, there is, I don't know, superiority complex, long list. But playing out in the context of apparent Sadhu Sangha. But that's actually a Sadhu Sangha. And that's a tricky Sadhu Sangha because overtly it looks like Sadhu Sangha. So that's even more complicated, more tricky, more dangerous in one sense. And the point is, we may be providing that to others. I'm not just saying this to point at anyone. We may be giving that quote-unquote Sadhu Sangha, which is actually a Sat Sangha. If we are not affectionate in how we relate to each other, if we are not honest, transparent, and so on and so forth. So this is what Rupa Goswami says, right? This is Sadhu Sangha. It has to be affectionate. There has to be care, concern, empathy, connection. Transparency, honesty. You take all the words out and you have Asat Sangha, not Sat Sangha. It's Asat. It's not true. Asat means false, true, untrue, hypocrite, dualistic, who knows what. Something that seems sad but is Asat. So.
Also, if you can take the Krishna out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 So many things, the point is so many things can be Asat Sangha, right? It's so easy to engage in Asat Sangha. In one sense, it's a challenge to engage in Sadhu Sangha proper. No, not to make this sound impossible, it's not impossible. It may not be easy in a sense of it's not a cheap thing. There has to be some conscious investment. Okay, do I want Sadhu Sangha in my life or not? And if the answer is yes, maybe the next question is, am I willing to provide that to others also? Again, not because, no, I cannot give Sadhu Sangha because I'm not a sadhu. Again, I'm not talking sadhu about topmost saintly person. Just be honest and sincere. And you may tell me, I'm not honest and sincere, Maharaj. Well, try it. Try it. Try your best. No? If we are not even trying our best, then what are we doing? No? So also it's important that, okay, I want sadhu sangha, but am I providing sadhu sangha? Am I willing to embrace affection, honesty, sincerity, to connect with people on a personal level, like living beings? Because if I'm not willing to pay that price, probably I won't be receiving that gift either, right? So sadhu sangha has to do with all the things. So. And that's why I say that Rupa Goswami makes it clear in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, and I mentioned why, because of these three attributes he ascribes to sadhu sangha. And also he makes that clear in Upadeshamrita. So I'd like to conclude with that section, which of course invites us to talk so much. And it's such a beautiful verse, with a few words on verse 4 of Upadeshamrita. Tadati prati grinati guhyamakyati prichati umte bojayate shaiva sadvidham priti lakshanam. So again, we go here to what we were talking right now. I say snegdasya, sadhu sangha has to be affectionate. And Rupa Goswami speaks here about sadvidham priti lakshanam, six loving exchanges. It has to be priti, it has to be affectionate and love. Interestingly, Prabhupada in the commentary to this verse, he says, by just following this verse, you can attain Krishna prem. In other words, by doing sadhu sangha proper, the goal of life comes to you. So here, as we know what it would say there in brief, it's a giving and receiving dynamics, as you know, no? Give and receive gifts, give and receive prasad, give and receive your heart, basically. And ultimately, I like always to concentrate more on this guhyam akyati prichati. Give and receive your heart, and that's ultimately the gift, and that's ultimately the prasad, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not denying giving prasad proper and gift of another type, but if I'm not giving my heart, to you, and I give you prasad and gifts, but my heart is not there, it's like, But if I'm giving my heart, if I may not have any gifts, any food to feed you, heart is the food, heart is the water, heart is the ornament, the gift, right? So I like to always concentrate in this line, which basically Rupa Goswami says, you have to open your heart in front of another person. Again, in sadhu sangha, which means there has to be sincerity from both sides. With this, I'm not promoting, just reveal your mind to everyone and anyone without any criterion and be vulnerable to the first person you cross on the street. No. You have to do it with people that know what to do with that. Because not everyone is willing to do something with your heart, so to say. Try it. Make an experiment, if you will. You go to the street and say to someone, I would like to give you my heart. And the person will call an Uber as quick as possible. Like, this is too much. I would like to give myself to you. I would like to full... It's intimidating. It's a big commitment, right? It's not a joke. If someone wants to really give their life to you or trust you or open their hearts, you have to open yours. No, there's no way around it. It's not that, okay, you fully open your heart and I just witness that absolutely closed, not shutting my no, that doesn't work. So giving implies receiving, no? And receiving is a form of giving also. I like to say that because sometimes we emphasize a lot of, in our tradition, giving, serving, giving, giving, and it's beautiful. I'm not against that. But receiving is also part of this verse, right? Rupa Goswami says half of the equation is giving, but half of the equation is receiving, also learning to receive, no? Honoring the gift. And receiving also means to give the other person the chance to give. So it's a form of giving. If I don't want to receive, you want to give me something and I'm denying to receive, I'm not giving you the opportunity to give. So even the receiving is a form of giving. If it's difficult for us to, no, I don't want to receive, I only want to give. Receiving is also giving, no problem, you can do it. And sometimes it's more difficult for many of us to receive than to give. Sometimes we even indulge in over-giving, so we don't have to realize how difficult it is for us to receive. Because we may feel we are not worthy, or because it's a commitment unto itself, it's humbling. We have to open ourselves to receive.
She's giving.
giving and receiving.
Okay, let's do some change. It's a big, very big garland for you, but we can do a double. We're gonna do double. Yeah, she's seeing what to do. Huh? For those who are seeing online, we are exchanging gifts with Kunja. She has my garland, and I have her. How do you call it? Yo-yo. Okay. In Spanish, this won't be seen very highly, a yo-yo, because yo-yo means I. No, in Spanish, yo is I. So it sounds like the personification of a hamameti, no? Like I am in mine. No? But I'm taking that from her heart. So anyhow, Rupa Goswami is speaking there about sadhu sangha, basically. That fourth verse of Upadeshamrita is sadhu sangha, how we are expected to relate with one another. Establishing this first foundation, it has to be snigdasya, svatavara, svajatya. Now what? Open your heart to each other. Give gifts to each other. Even gifts, like a gift. Don't wait for the yearly birthday. Right. No? Like be spontaneous in love, in showing affection to someone. Like, I have a gift for you. Even if the person, but why today? It's not my birthday. Because I love you. Because I'm grateful. Because I appreciate. I want to express my affection. Even the gift of some words of appreciation. We don't need to, for it to be a special moment. Every moment is special if we are willing to make it special, to contact the speciality of every moment. So I think that's important also to keep it spontaneous, you know, like how we relate to each other with, hey, I have a gift for you. I have, yeah, prasad, of course, is Krishna's grace. You know? So I'm extending Krishna's grace to you. But especially, yeah, revealing our minds in confidence and receiving each other's mind. That's sadhu sangha. Again, that goes back to our original definition. Be honest, no? Sadhu, like attachment to be authentic, attachment to be transparent, just to show up for who I am. That's such a, I mean, that all every time that I have the chance of whether revealing my mind in confidence or receiving someone else's heart with trust and authenticity, generally those are like most of the most transforming moments in my life. And many times the receiving is equally or more transforming. It's not that when I happen to be revealing my mind, that's the most intense moment. Sometimes it's receiving and listening and being able to witness and connect with the person, be empathic, tadatmya, be empathic with the person. That's the beginning of love, basically, as we were talking yesterday. No? To listen, to receive one's heart means to listen to the person. And Shravan is part of that for me. When we say Shravan, Kirtan, and Vishnu, Shman, it all begins hearing. It's not only sit in the Bhagavatam class and hear. Learn to listen to each other. That's also Shravan. And that's the beginning of love. If I love you, if I would like to love you, first I will express that by I'm willing to hear you, to listen to you. If I'm not willing to listen to you, and I tell you, but I love you, it's like, that's the world. It doesn't make any sense. Any sense. But if a person is really invested, I'm there for you, listening to you, you really start to think, okay, this guy loves me for some reason. This person has something special with me. So I'm attached to be open, to reveal my mind, to give my heart, to trust. So listening is a great art, especially in this age where we are not so much accustomed to listen. We are not so much accustomed to be present, to be attentive. Our attention is like vyabhyasi atmika buddhikiha kuru nandana bahu sakas hinantascha. It's unlimitedly multi-branched. That's interesting how the Gita depicts it. Multi-branched in every possible direction. So we need to bring this ekagra, this like one-pointedness. And in part that's also to be applicable when we relate to one another. It's not just think about Krishna and never forget him. Yes, also, but a way of doing exercising that is be present for one another and give the other person the gift of your attention, the gift of your investment of time. Again, as we say before, I give your time and giving you Krishna. I'm fully present here for you. I care for you. Even if you don't say any words, but if you really genuinely are there listening to each other, that's what the other person receives. Care, concern, validation of their existence. As simple as that sounds, If I'm not willing to listen to you, and I'm not saying that, but I'm just like, I don't care, I'm not validating your existence. I basically tell you, you are not important for me. But sometimes it extends to, you are not important. That's how we take that. Oh, I'm not important. And there are so much people who think, I'm unworthy, I'm unlovable, and so on. All this I do not exist almost. I'm not important. And from there to think my life doesn't have any meaning, I'm taking the steps to end it, that's not so far. But it all begins with them feeling unloved, unlovable, unworthy. So we have to be very careful that we are not creating or augmenting those things that may be in someone else also by our lack of presence, our lack of attention. It's not that, no, I'm not insulting anyone. I'm not beating anyone physically. Yeah, but if you're absent when you should be present, that's a form of violence. Ahimsa takes so many forms. It's not only about being vegetarian. If I'm not listening to you when you need to be listened, that's violence. That's not affection. That's not pretty lakshana. So anyhow, sadhu sangha has to do with this, to be present for each other, to be willing to be present. That takes time. That's not a joke, again, if you want to. And takes time means also, I'm willing to have sadhu sangha with everyone, but in some point, in certain relationships that I want to go deep, I don't have time to go to that depth with 14,000 people, so to say. So in some relationships that are important, people telling my life, I will be willing to invest hours and hours of listening to each other and talk. And it's a way of showing affection, right? That's how we show affection for each other. So anyhow, some thoughts. I don't want to overextend myself, and also I want to ask if you have any comments or questions. But I wanted just to make a few points in connection to sadhu sangha, so we kind of like refresh. No, we no longer have F5 to update, right? I'm a little bit old school for this. He's even laughing at me at that. You can imagine this new generation, they don't know what's F5. Keeps laughing. Okay. No problem.
Sorry.
So, but yeah, a few ideas so we can update these terms. Okay, sadhu sangha. So every time we say sadhu sangha, we are not taking it lightly, so to say. We are bearing in mind all that it implies and trying, again, in a sustainable way as much as we can, but to honor the actual meaning of the word in practice in how we relate to each other. So. Sadhu sangha ki.
Yes.
So, now Rasa, have some questions, yeah. Comments?
First, Shruti, can you take charge? I have a question. You said about the single-pointedness in the context of like being attentive to someone, but that subject all really interests me of how one can be more one-pointed in general, and not many-branched or thinking like that. Yeah. Do you have anything to share about that?
We already did a whole podcast about that, Namrasa. Bhakti and social media.
Well, that's in the context of social media.
Yeah, and that's a big aspect of my answer to your question. Okay. Like sometimes I joke with devotees that they ask Maharaj, how can I be more one-pointed and focused? And okay, let's go to the practical thing. Don't take your cell phone as the very first thing you do on your day. Let's begin with the first thing you do on your day. It's checking your cell phone. If that's the case, let's start there. I won't talk any further than that if you're still doing that. First do that. And let not be taking your cell phone and be the last thing you do of your day. Don't begin and close your day creating those samskars, because if you create that impression to begin with and to close with, probably all that happens in between will be quite related to that. Like when you say you understand the subject of a book by paying attention to what it says in the beginning at the end. So, again, I'm not saying that's all I have to say in that connection, but going to the practicality of our daily postmodern dynamics, make an effort for that to be the case, no? Like, let's not take the phone as the very first, like, message that we give to the world on the day. Because generally we say, no, Maharaj, I have the alarm in my watch, so I have to take it first. But generally it's not just, okay, off alarm and there I go, shower, achaman, sadhana, prayer. It's like achaman, prayer, and sadhana. Yeah. It's all there now. Yeah. You follow. So So that's something, but that's a lot. No, I think technology, I have nothing against technology, it's facilitating all this. But it can be really invasive and create a very dysfunctional pattern in how our brain works. Now, I mean, there are many books even with scientific research and on how your brain is affected by technology, basically. And that's scary. I read a few of them. I needed to read them to be intimidated enough to take some practical stances. Like, wow, I don't want my brain to become that. And I already feel it's affected. I mean, I like to read and I like to memorize verses, and but I can feel how the machine is not as working as it was working 20 years ago. Of course, I'm getting old also, but I can feel the distracting presence of social media and multitasking and other things that the brain starts to deal with more things that it's capable of dealing. Or like we were talking the other day, and I don't want to just go on a detour, but the other day we were talking about that, about, for example, being compassionate and connecting with the world's suffering in a compassionate way. But also before globalization, we didn't know about what was going on around everywhere. So you were compassionate, you were trying to connect with the world around you, but the world around you was your village and some other places nearby. But now you receive a bombarding of what's going on in every single corner. And you don't have the capacity to. We are not Paramatma. No, we cannot deal with the whole suffering of the whole planet and remain sober. But we are receiving this excessive amount of information, and most of them is not very positive. So that can really, again, create another form of distraction and disruption in how our brain works. So sometimes we need to, not to be indifferent to what's going on in the world, but to know our capacity to process amount of information and remain sober. So that's something. And again, as simple as that may sound, trying to do one thing at a time, right? So if I will chant japa, I will chant japa. I'm not doing 2, 3, 4 other things. I know it's not easy sometimes, but I'm not driving and taking care of my kids and checking Facebook and cooking and listening in class and chanting japa. You're not chanting japa, sorry. And probably you are not doing anything else, especially if you are driving. Don't chant japa. I don't want you chanting japa while driving if I'm in that car. That's dangerous. Because you are trying to do two things and you are not doing any of the two in depth. So to say, and that's the thing, we are losing depth. We're talking about that in the morning. Like, we do many things superficially, but not one thing deeply. And when we are talking absorbing the mind, we are talking about trying to go deep into something. And for that, sometimes we need to reduce the multitasking. Now, the other day I was talking with one devotee in Michigan about that. And he was basically asking the same question, and what we were concluded was like, pay attention to all the things you do in your day and be honest about if some of those things actually you don't need to do them, but you are doing them because, of course, that was a personal situation, but he was of the idea is as much as I do, the better. No, like the multitasking template appears also in this superhero archetype. Like, I need to do all the services and cooking and cleaning and chanting and preaching and this and that. The more I do, the more Krishna will like me or something like that. But he was like, but I'm scattered all over around and I don't feel I can go deep in something. So we're like, well, start doing a little less. Pick those things that you know they are essential and profound and try to go deep in them. And sometimes that requires you stop, you sit down, you make a list, you think about it. Because if not, it won't happen automatically. Automatically, you just be carried by the motions, the waves of the day. So you may need to have a conscious effort to first detect what I need to adjust, what can I do to change? No, because what I want to change, okay, what are you willing to do to change? Because you have to ask yourself, I'm willing to do this? I don't want to cheat myself if I'm not willing to do. So like I tell you, okay, don't check your phone first thing in the day. Then the question is, I'm willing to do that? I'll probably say, no. Okay, so we cannot speak about this, speak about something else because you are not willing to do that. What are you willing to do? Well, you have to ask yourself, what I'm willing to do? Okay, this. Okay. But I'm able to do that, or I'm willing to do something that is too much. Because sometimes also, okay, I'm willing to do this, but we put the scale too high and we are not able to do it either. And we fail and we get frustrated. Oh no, I continue doing normal because I cannot do that. No, maybe you need to put the bar a little lower. So you find a point of doing something that you are willing to do, that you can do, and that then you do it. And then you do it every day. It's not like, okay, today I will change my life. And you make a day like a superhero template, 64 rounds, and I won't sleep, and I will eat the... I find the day, at the end of the day, I did it. How much you can sustain that? How balanced was your day, even if you did that? Where was your mind? So also I will say we have to make micro adjustments. Don't try to think from today to next week, extreme change. It's gradual, day after day, but make it sustainable. Like again, it sounds silly, but don't take your phone first thing in the day. And that's why I say, I won't say anything else apart from that. Try to do that for a week. I'm not saying even for a year. I will make a vow in front of the fire for the rest of my life. No, no, no. Try a week. Probably you will fail miserably. Hopefully not. But we need to put ourselves to test and try things that are sustainable and incremental progress. No? There's so much studies about incremental progress instead of like huge quantum leaps that are unsustainable. I've seen so many people with good intention, but just sometimes over-idealizing how transformation happens and just romanticizing. I don't know. They listen to a class from me and then like, Maharaj, I became inspired to become a sannyasi. And I'm like, yeah. Let's talk tomorrow about it. And tomorrow, so, no, it's gone. So also we need to see, to put to test our excitement and okay, let's see. Like when I myself was, I don't want to talk about me, but just when I was invited to accept sannyas, I remember I talked to a sannyasi friend of mine at that time, and he told me, why don't you think, take 10 years to think about that? So I was like, wow, it's nice, interesting. I appreciate the, he didn't say, think about that for a weekend or for a few months. He told me, think about that for a decade, and let's see where you are after the decade. So I waited a decade. I took that to heart and I felt like it makes sense. It's not a joke. And I can be so different from, I mean, at that time I was 22. So how mature you are at 22 to take a lifelong vow. Anyhow, that's another conversation. But so it helped me a lot to wait almost 10 years. I don't want to put myself as an example. It was just that I received that very nice input, like take 10 years for that. Wait. And meanwhile, try to do something, try to grow, try to settle and prepare, so to say. So anyhow, those are some things I will. But I would say it's important to even practices, even if it sounds silly, practices of bringing us to the present moment. No? And of course, you hear about things like mindfulness in other traditions. But or like the other day we were talking with someone, there are this meditation of just try to, if you are placed with birds, try to listen to the birds and like pay attention to the different sounds of the birds. Like try to train your mind. I mean, I'm not creating here new Anga of Sadhana. I'm just saying, like giving an example of you like consciously take your mind to pay attention to and to be in the present moment. And that's a way of, I'm not saying you have to do that, but whatever it works for you, but a way of bringing your mind here and now. Because generally the mind is going shopping, past and future. So present moment, Sakshitva, Bhagavatam will say, Sakshitva, witnesshood. Try to be a witness. Try to be here. Train your mind to be in the present. And when it's going back. Yeah. So I think I told you once, when I come, especially to your house, I really appreciate being here because witnessing the intensity of being a parent, the beautiful intensity and how it demands that you are in the present moment in one sense. No, your kids bring, your mind may go here and there, but the kids are like, wah! So you are forced to coexist with present. No? So that's important. That's beautiful. Of course, that's not all. We have to be fully present for Krishna and so on and so forth, but to be in the present moment is so important. So important. So whenever when we are chanting japa, ideally it's that. You have to be in the present moment with the whole name. As simple as that sounds, that's what's going on. It's a personal dialogue and communication in the here and now, because Krishna's not in the past. Krishna's not a past person. Krishna's not a future person. Krishna lives in the eternal present. So you can only have an experience of the relationship with Krishna. The present moment. And sattva has to do with that mostly to begin with. No? Tamas is more like the past and nostalgia and depression and trying to bring back past experiences to lead them back again. It cannot happen, but trying. Rajas is more about the future and projection and plans and desires and anxiety and trying to have things happening in a certain way. And sattva means present, being here, attentive. Being present to the present. Interestingly, the word present, I like, again, to make a play of words. Not only present is a tense, not present tense, present time. It's also to be present, but also it's to give a present. It's a gift. So the best present you can give is to be present in the present. Right? It's not redundant. Anyhow, some thoughts.
Thank you.
But let's start with the cell phone. That's a good point to begin with. Something else? Any other question or comments or sharing of any type? Venkata Bhatta Prabhu?
First of all, thank you so much. This is such a beautiful way of deepening and understanding of Sadhguru. So two takeaways for me right now are the importance of honesty and the importance of genuine affection in Sadhu Sangha. And so I wanted to ask you about what I think sometimes we experience in devotional communities where sometimes it can feel like in the name of sort of in the name of trying to, I'm going to use the cliche phrase, keep Krishna in the center, we try to bypass the honesty part. Like, let's not dwell on negativity, or let's not dwell on our own, you know, it's just like, oh, just chant Hare Krishna and be happy, right? Like that kind of a spiritual bypass. Mm-hmm. So I would love to hear some thoughts about that. And then on a similar sort of challenge is, I think, on the affection side, often, either explicitly or more subtly, there's like this push that our love, our affection, again, should be directed to Krishna.
Yeah.
And there's a kind of, I don't know if it's stated so explicitly, but there's a kind of like ghost of an idea floating around that somehow if we are too affectionate with each other, we'll get distracted from being affectionate or loving towards Krishna.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have 5 more hours because each question requires its whole presentation.
We'll also just do a podcast about this.
We will. This is a trailer of tomorrow's meeting, yeah, but I'll say something, of course. But yeah, these are very important topics. So going to the first question, and I kind of recapitulate for the ones who are here live, may not hear what Venkata Bhatta said in connection to honesty and how sometimes honesty in the name of keeping Krishna in the center in our relationships is kind of bypassed. And as you say, the famous and sometimes dangerous one-liner chant and be happy. I mean, it's not dangerous in itself, but how we take it. So that's what, again, we call spiritual bypassing. Basically, we are using all these beautiful ideas and knowledge and lines, but in a different way, you know, to escape, as escapism, basically. So I agree that this happens. And with this, we are not, again, it's not pointing to any particular community nor individual, or if it's someone to point to is myself to begin with, because who is free from that fully and consciously, that may be there. I remember when I will talk with a friend of mine, Deva Madhav Prabhu from the Harmony Collective, he says that he doesn't say chant and be happy. He says chant and be honest. And he adjusted the line. In this, implying we are talking about honesty, right? No? You want happiness, but you have to be honest. I mean, see, if not, what do you understand by happiness? Just like a dopamine peak, something like that. Now, sometimes we may become like, how to say, happiness junkies. No? I just want to be happy, always happy, happy. But that's not how life operates. That's not normal. There has to be a polarity also. There has to be the pain and other emotions. I mean, even in eternity. No, you see the five primary rasas, yes, Santa Dasya Sakya Vatsalya Madhurya. But then you have the seven secondary rasas, and there is compassion, there is anger, there's all these type of things going on eternally in the spiritual world. In their own unique way, of course. But there is pain in eternity. There is pain in love. I mean, you hear all this description of the suffering of Sri Radha and separation of Krishna and vice versa, to the point of feeling that they are dying. And I like to say, actually, that's actual pain. We think we are suffering. Wait till you get Prem. Then you will know the real meaning of suffering. That's actual suffering. And that's not something bad. Again, no? Don't feel that, oh, suffering. Because we project our own experience of that when we hear suffering. But when you suffer in love, that's absolutely different. There is a sweetness in pain. So divine love seems like poison outside, but it's full of ananda inside. So yeah, I will say that many times in the name of, again, keeping Krishna in the center, but what does it mean? In that case, I will say we are using Krishna to avoid our inner work, to avoid our shadow work, as Jung will say, or an art nivritti. The very first line of Mahaprabhu Sikshastakam says what? Cheta darpana marjana. Cheta can be translated as subconscious, the subconscious mind. Darpana marjana, clean the mirror of your subconscious, basically. Confront your subconscious. That's the first thing that Mahaprabhu says in the Sikshastakam. Whoops. That's basically it. No, we have to be courageous. That's the Gundicha Marjan Lila all about. No? Clean everything, every single thing, speck of dust. Again, let's inspect. Let's be exhaustive in our examination. Not neurotic, not crazy, but just honest about it. No? So for me, the actual question will be in that case, and that's connected to the second part of your question, why we don't want to go there. Why we do not want to be honest. And of course, sometimes it's unfortunately because that's not being promoted as a value. That's not kind of the norm. No? So sometimes we arrive to a place and we don't see that everyone is being honest. So we just, okay, fit in with the wave of like performance. No? Like we were talking the other day with the devotee about performative versus transformative. So Krishna consciousness has to be transformative, but sometimes we end up performing, no? Saying the correct things, hi, Jai, Hari Bol, chant and be happy. But on the behind the curtains, everyone is having their own issues and the things that they need to deal, to talk about, to share. Because if not, we get together for the Sunday feast, all have the best weekly smile for each other. But then each other will go back home with their own unresolved stuff and feeling, I cannot share this at the temple. No, maybe I have to share it with someone else. And it's okay. I have nothing against that. But ideally, a temple should be a place of sharing and openness and communion and empathy and sincerity. And I'm not saying that's not there in many places. I'm just saying what a temple should be. And sometimes, again, going back, the second part of your question has to do with affection and loving each other. So sometimes people is afraid of being honest because they fear, if I'm honest, I will be rejected. I won't be accepted. I won't be loved. I want to be loved, but sometimes, unfortunately, this short-circuiting comes. I want to be loved. I desperately need to be loved, but I cannot be honest. Because if I'm honest, I won't be loved. So you get that message, and there is, so for me to be loved, I have to stop being honest. And that's a tragic conclusion. But many people think like that. I need to be loved, I want to be loved, but I cannot show myself vulnerably in all my brokenness, or if I have doubts, if I have even crisis. Mm. That's not allowed. Well, you will be looked at like weirdly. That shouldn't happen. That shouldn't happen. If you have a cry, I know devotees when confidence come to me and say, Maharaj, I have doubts that Krishna is a person. And I'm like, I'm not saying great that you have the doubt, but great that you are approaching, great that you are courageous enough to bring. That shows your trust. That shows your willingness to solve that, to clarify that. So that's the main thing for me. Not so much, how can you doubt that Krishna is a person? You are bordering in personalism. What offense might you have? But many people fearing those types of replies or having already received them, it's like, they'll receive that message shut down. No doubts, no questions. But everything becomes so superficial in those cases. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important that we promote the culture of honesty. And of course, we have to begin giving the example of that, not being transparent, talking about whatever needs to be talked about. There are not taboo topics. You need to talk about anything that's welcome. You are validated in your need, so to say. Because if not, yeah, people is confuses, okay, fitting in with belonging. I make that difference in my book. No, it's not the same. Belonging is you are accepted for who you are. Yeah. But sometimes we use the words interchangeably. No. But belonging is, in order for to belong, you have to be who you are. In order to fit in, you have to stop pretend. Being who you are. You have to pretend, you have to perform, and you fit in. No, you adjust to fit the box, so to say. And many times the box is, you have to be perfect in this, paka in this, perform this way. And it's a character. It's not yourself. So in time, it's unsustainable. It's toxic. You are promoting hypocrisy. You are promoting dualism, so to say.
As a virtue.
As a virtue. Yeah. As a preliminary necessity to be part of this. It's like, that's exact opposite of our tradition. But sometimes, and again, I'm not criticizing our tradition. That happens in everywhere. That's human condition. So we need to work on that, because if not... So in connection to the loving part, again, as you yourself mentioned, all this situation with love and being need to be loved and loving others, sometimes it's so stigmatized or so misunderstood that we receive this like very, how to say, I would say superficial idea that only love Krishna. Only Krishna can be loved. Everything else... No. If you love someone else, means that you are not giving that love could be given to Krishna, and you are giving that to your children. That's Maya, and it's like no, that's his function. That's his function. No? Yes, of course.
Yes, in the 13th chapter, Krishna lists the item of amanitam adambitam. In that list of items of knowledge, Krishna says attachment to children, family, etc. Or detachment, whatever you should give up.
Mm.
So that's an easy one for us to grab onto and if you want to bypassing.
Mm.
But if you read the purport, Prabhupada says this. He says, as for detachment from children, wife, and home, it is not meant that one should have no feeling for these.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Prabhupada, he saved us from our, if you read his purport, he saved us from the bypass. He says, they are natural objects of affection.
Jaya.
Prabhupada is not, I mean, if you read the purport, all the keys are there. So,
It's amazing. Yeah. And how I like to present that same idea in this way. Okay, you want to love Krishna. For example, the definition of bhakti given by Rupa Goswami, Anyavi Lasita Sunyam Gyan Karmadin, and so on, Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. The word Anushilanam in the purport, going back to the purport of Jiva Goswami, here he says Anushilana means an active culture of service to Krishna and also to everything related to Krishna. He says if we don't say this, we are given a narrow definition of bhakti. If we limit our expression of love only to Krishna, that's narrow-mindedness. So in order for the definition to be broad enough, and we want that, it includes whatever is related to Krishna, and everything is related to Krishna. Ultimately, there's nothing that exists unrelated to God. So in that sense, loving Krishna means loving everything. So technically speaking, we have no excuse to be unloving to anyone. Not even, okay, I love Krishna, he's devoted. I love Krishna, my family. Okay, great, you're extending something beyond Krishna, but eventually should encompass everything. That's a symptom of the highest devotee. They're loving everything because everything is connected to Krishna. Prabhupada will say, if you love me, love my dog, right? Love what is dear to me. So if you love Krishna, you have to love whatever is dear to Krishna. And Krishna has love for everyone. So we have no escape, so to say. Although we may try to bypass again, and no, only Krishna, but that's not Shastric. Again, we are sharing all these references to show, technically speaking, loving God means loving everything because nothing exists disconnected from God. And of course, that's a challenge. In one sense, it's easy to say, I only love Krishna. But okay, we have to begin somewhere. Okay, love someone. But the more you love Krishna, you realize, okay, Krishna is not alone. Krishna doesn't exist in a bubble. And, like the Kanishtha only sees Krishna in the altar. The Madhyam sees Krishna in every other person. The Uttam sees Krishna everywhere. And it's not only seeing Krishna, but loving Krishna. So, if we don't do that, we become so dysfunctional. And of course, we have historical reference and trauma we are still healing from. And we should grieve properly. Not without condemning anyone, but just learning from even past mistakes and trying to refine the gift we can give in our present generation. Because I appreciate what my ancestors did, also sometimes I'll try to improve the gift. Not because I'm better than them, just because it's how parampara works. You can always refine everything more and more and more. So, we have to be humans again. We don't not only have to be devoted, we have to be humans. Because we have to integrate both things, humanity and transcendence. Only transcendence without humanity, that becomes spiritual bypassing, escapism, indifference, the rejection, and we orient our whole practice in terms of negativity, detachment and rejection. And well, actually, bhakti is all about, Prabhupada will say, it's all about attachment. It's not about rejecting anything. As I said when I was with your Guru Maharaj last year in Alachua, and we ended up talking like 4 hours, and at one point he quoted one thing that Prabhupada said, that someone came to Prabhupada and said, Prabhupada, for your sake, I'm willing to reject everything. It's a very negative orientation, right? I'm willing to reject everything. And he probably said, the only thing you need to reject is the idea that you have to reject something. You have to reject something, the idea that you have to reject something. We don't need to reject anything. Everything is to be accepted, integrated in the bhakti equation, so to say. So family doesn't need to be rejected. No? Family are Vaishnavas. No? If you're a devotee and your wife and your children, I remember once I was with a devotee and said, I miss Sadhu Sangha so much. And it's like, you have your wife, your children, all of them are Vaishnavas. That's Sadhu Sangha. Don't lose sight of that. So anyhow, we want to remain human beings also. Our goal is Nara Lila. Nara means human. Human. So we want to relate to Krishna in his fully human, fully divine Lila. Nara Lila is fully human, fully divine, but fully human. So if we are not fully humans ourselves, how do we expect to enter that realm? We cannot go with the half-baked, dysfunctional humanity pretending to, telling Jai Vijay, allow me to enter further here by Kunta, get to Golok, the land of full humanity. And they will say, you need therapy first. They may have some department at the entrance of the spiritual world for those who still need some further refinement. You go to the purgatory, like the psycho-emotional purgatory. You spend there a few months, and then we admit you. You will create chaos in Gola with that half-baked humanity. So yeah, we need to love. To love our family, we can love friends. I mean, remember the first podcast we did? The first thing you say, I'm here super excited with my new friend, Padmanabhaswamy. But Maharaj, can sannyasis have friends? Remember you telling me that? And I was horrified. That was my introduction to the Namrasa podcast. Like, what are you talking about?
It wasn't exactly like that, Maharaj.
I mean,
it was, I said, my new friend, I was like, oh, can I see that? Because some other sannyasi told me,
yeah,
you can't really be friends with
sannyasi. I'm not saying you were proposing that. You heard that from someone. Just in case, doing justice.
Say that history correctly, Maharaj.
I was getting there, but I started with a clickbait first.
Okay, yeah.
You cannot go against that. You are the acharya of that. You are the guru of the clickbait. So don't contradict your own principles.
You're right.
So my point is, when he said that to me, I was like, some people think that sannyasi cannot have friends. That's like, I'm ready to leave my sannyasi if that's the case. Mm-hmm. If I have to choose between having friends or remaining a sannyasi, here you have all my saffron, and I keep with my friends. So to say, I'm not leaving my boss just in case. But my point is, I need friends. It's not like I'm a sannyasi. I don't need friends. I'm transcendental to affection. Mm. That sounds to sound like apasiddhanta. You're very, very weird thinking. I don't need affection. I don't need friends. I mean, again, go back to all the quotes that we shared today about affection and love and empathy and connection. So yeah, we have to be careful not to make of Krishna consciousness something that is not, basically. Mm. Something renunciation oriented and rejection of this world and rejection of affection and rejection of relationship. It all that boils down to one word, which is impersonalism. If you play out the implication of that, that's impersonalism in so many ways. How we relate to others, how we relate to ourselves, to the family, to the world. And our tradition is not impersonalism, it's radical personalism. So, but sometimes we represent something hyper-personalist in impersonal ways. So that's the most unbecoming thing on earth. So that's why I'm getting fired up and why I wrote the whole book about radical personalism. Because sometimes we are pretty impersonal, depersonalizing relationships with us, family, ourselves, the body, the world. Okay, we are not this body, but I don't have to be neglectful and indifferent to something that is a vehicle that I have to honor. It's a gift. It's matter, yeah, but matter is sacred energy also. So Natan Goswami said, Maya Shakti material energy is the highest devotee of Krishna. So I have to relate to matter. If not, I commit Vaishnavi aparat. I don't want to do that. Anyhow, some thoughts. I hope that helped, Venkata, but thank you for your questions. Okay. Something else? Kumari, yes.
I'm thinking about the external structure of a lot of the kind of sadhu sangha events or engagements or programs, as we call them, in our community. And thinking about the structure of it. And I remember when I was a young girl going to the temple, my ashram leaders always told us, you're not allowed to socialize at the temple. Temple's not for socializing. You go there, you go to kirtan, you listen to class, you have prasad. Like, what room is there for the heart-to-heart connections? Mm. And is that supposed to happen on one's own time? And is there a way that we can build it into the daily lives of somehow, like, into the structure? Is that something that is meant to be built into the structure, or is it an underlying mood of how we approach our interactions?
Yeah, I get your point. I hear you. Thank you. So, my personal opinion, I feel that we need to build into the structures, and not new, because it's not new, but to introduce more dynamics of personal interaction and sharing in the context of our practice. Now, even if it's not the official program, again, I'm not here trying to disrupt tradition, so to say. I'm okay with arti and kirtan and lecture, but sometimes lectures are unidirectional also. I'm very vertical. One talking and everyone else listening, which is okay. I have nothing against that. But also I think it's very important to have like more like lateral sharing, no? like circle. Like recently we have been doing that in Michigan and in other retreats, just to give an example, no? And how powerful that was. Now, apart from some presentations I was giving and other devotees were giving, with Jai Jagannath Prabhu also, we were organized like a circle. We were like 30 people, but a few of us, seven of us, were like invited to share their journey in bhakti in different main stages and sharing some of their struggles, and which were like, to give you an example, I was sharing, okay, who I was before being a devotee and which was my goal, my need at the time. And when I met that need, eventually that need became a new statu quo. So what's the next question that comes? And that next question sets me on a quest. And then I reach the goal of the quest, then a new question comes. And we did like four circles in that connection and sharing, of course, some of our struggles and difficulties. It was a very vulnerable sharing. Of course, for that you first have to craft what we will call safe space. Right, because if you are not able to create safe space for sharing openly, everyone is terrified. Everyone will be like, "I won't go there. That's too risky." But if the elders, so to say, of the ones who are leading by example and being honest and open and sincere, everyone feels okay. There's place for that. It's not risky. I'll try. So we did that in two sessions. Totally was kind of like 8 hours. But seven of us were sharing in circle and the others were like witnessing. So it also was presented like that. It's not like, okay, you are over there listening, doing nothing. No, you are witnessing and you are holding space for the rest to express their heart and vulnerability and share their journey. And by witnessing their journey, probably you will relate to your own journey. And of course, there were so many things expressed, and crying and grieving and celebration and joy. I mean, so many things happen in life. But that was the main central activity, basically. You know, like each one sharing and each one listening to each other and being present to each other and witnessing without interrupting, without trying to even give advice to the other person, like, you should do this. No. Just listen and receive. Allow the person to be received and listen for next turn. So we did like a circle. It was super powerful. I mean, you can imagine, people was like, wow. No, it's not that there were full answers to everything, but just the fact that we can bear our souls together and be honest with one another, transparent. There were no judgments, no bias, no assumptions. Everyone was welcome with their messiness and with their doubts and with their crisis. But everyone went out of that super inspired. I'm feeling hope. Okay, we can do that. It's possible to talk and to listen and to share. So I'm not saying this has to replace every single program from now on and you have to do that. But I would say somehow or other it's important to have those spaces and to promote them and to even sometimes make a concerted effort to create that, because it may not happen spontaneously if you don't say, okay, guys, today we'll do this. We'll sit in circle and we'll be sure. If you craft it, okay, and you lead by example with your own vulnerability and openness, okay. And once that starts to unfold, it becomes natural. It was funny because in this retreat, we did this circle one day and the next day. So we kind of enter into this dynamics of, and after the circle was over, we were having lunch, but we couldn't but continue the circle during lunch for 4 hours again. But it was not forced. It was just like natural outflow. And then the next day I visited the devotee to his house, and again we started, but not planned, again naturally. So I felt like, yeah, that's beautiful. That's how the Sangha, right? We are revealing our minds in a natural way and sharing our journey and connecting with each other's journey and realizing, okay, I'm not alone in this experience. All of us are going through similar, or even if it's not what I'm going through, I'm learning from that. Incredible, because some of the circle were the boats who were starting, I don't know, this year. And then I came myself with my own issues, so to say, my 25-year story and my situation. And for some of them, it's like, I definitely never gone through that. and I hope they don't. But my point is, but nonetheless, that helps me a lot to learn that can happen. So it opens eyes and it's very experiential, right? It gives an indirect experience, very somatic even. People crying and opening their heart and smiling. So I think that's very, very complementary, I would say. Again, not to cancel any of the other functions, but I think it's important that we get those spaces, because if not, again, it can be pretty impersonal. Just like, okay, go for the kirtan, go for the class, prasadam, see you next Sunday. And it's like, okay, but no, I need to relate, to talk, to commune, to, okay, find that yourself outside via WhatsApp group, organize yourself. Yeah, but I will say that ideally, of course, if someone is not doing that, I'm of the idea of don't just throw stones. Oh, the temple is not doing that. They are not doing what you start doing that. No. Sometimes we kind of just wait for everyone else to do what we think must be done. So if someone else is doing that, great. You can join them. If they are not doing that, you can do that. And if you are not willing to do that, don't just criticize the others who aren't doing that, right? Just get out of the way, I will say. But yeah, I will say that's important. Somehow or other, if it's not in the official, I don't know, temple program, hosting some spaces or circles, because also some of that may be more intimate. Sometimes it's not just, okay, let everyone come and let's just reveal our minds. Who are you? I don't know you. I mean, so, but at least to make it clear that this is necessary for everyone, in one form or another. So to normalize vulnerability, to normalize authenticity, to normalize reveal, to make it part of our sadhana, revealing our minds, no? Like part of our sadhana, chanting my rounds, worshiping my deity, studying my Bhagavad, revealing my mind, no? In a healthy way, not like, okay, you have to go and confess your sins to the priest on Sunday, no? Do it, go. Okay, no, I'm not saying that, right? Yeah, and the confession shouldn't be that either, right? It should be voluntary. I'm opening my heart and I'm receiving feedback and vice versa. So that's what comes. So yeah, I hope that creates some input. And it can begin on a very localized level. It can begin between you and your husband, so to say. It's not that we need the whole community there. It can begin with 1, 2, 3 like-minded spirits that we all resonate with each other. Let's get together once a week for an hour. Again, it doesn't have to be a grand arrangement to begin with. And gradually, it has a life of its own and it unfolds naturally. Yeah. That is necessary. Yeah. It can prevent so many people even leaving and losing their faith. And because I would say many people who leave the movement basically leave because of that. Because of lack of connection and personal relationship and belonging and sense of community and family, and they don't feel they are important, that people don't care for about them, and we all need that. So that can be so preventive. Not only because of that, not just to prevent them from leaving. That's not the real purpose of that. That's a byproduct of that. But to nourish our journey and to know you can always talk and open and communicate everything. That open door, if it remains open, is such a relief. I know that open door is there. I know that people that I trust are always there and I can fully be myself. Oof. Sounds simple, be yourself. Try it. And we need, again, a supportive group for that. We need Sangha, no? Going back to full circle, no? Sadhu Sangha. Ki Jai. Sriman Mahaprabhu Ki Jai. Sri Harinam Sankirtan Ki Jai. Gaur Bhaktavrinda Ki Jai. Gaur Premananda Sadhu Sangha Ki Jai. Oh, Hari Bol.